Okay, let's unpack this. I want you to picture the ultimate leather-clad, cigarette-smoking rock and roll rebel. Like, really visualize that guy in your head. Got him.
I mean, I think we all have that exact image burned into our brains, right?
Right, exactly. So now take that exact same guy, put him in a perfectly pressed choir uniform, and picture him standing in the middle of Westminster Abbey. He's hitting perfect high notes as a boy soprano for Queen Elizabeth II.
It totally shatters the whole illusion, doesn't it? But that is the actual real foundation we are dealing with here today.
Yeah, welcome to today's deep dive. We have this massive stack of biographical excerpts in front of us, and they are all focusing on a man who is, well, he's practically a piece of modern mythology at this point, Keith
Oh,
Richards.
absolutely. He's a legend.
Right. And our mission today is to look right past that famous rock star caricature. We want to dig down into the actual mechanics of a guy who created what Rolling Stone calls rock's greatest single body of riffs. I mean, he co-wrote 14 of their 500 greatest songs of all time.
And to understand how those riffs actually came to exist, we really have to throw out that whole image of the untamed, chaotic rock star. The sources make it very clear.
How so?
Well, you simply do not get that level of musical output without a massive amount of underlying rigor. To understand his music, we have to look at the deeply contrasting forces that built him from the ground up.
Yeah, I was reading through the notes on his childhood, and honestly, it sounds less like a typical upbringing and more like this intense sociological experiment.
That's a great way to put it, honestly.
Right, because he was born in December 1943, right into the rubble and the rationing of post-World War II England. At Livingston Hospital down in Dartford, Kent, he was an only child, too.
Right.
And from the moment he could walk, it feels like he was caught in this epic tug of war. On one end of the rope, you have this incredibly rigid, almost suffocating sense of civic duty. And then on the other end, just total bohemian freedom.
Yeah, the family dynamics mapped out in these excerpts lay that conflict out perfectly. If we look at the side of civic duty, it really starts with his father, Herbert.
Tell us about Herbert.
So Herbert was a factory worker and a veteran who had actually been wounded during the Normandy invasion. As you might expect from a traumatized war veteran in 1940s England, Herbert was highly practical.
And I'm guessing he wasn't exactly thrilled about a career in music.
Not at all. He actively, vocally disapproved of his son's obsession with music. He thought it was a waste of time.
Right, and that sense of duty wasn't just coming from his dad either. It was totally baked into the family legacy. The notes mention his paternal grandparents, Ernie and Eliza.
Yes, and they were formidable figures, highly disciplined, active socialists who literally helped build the Walthamstow Labor Party from the ground up.
Wow, so really involved in the community.
Exactly. Eliza even served as the mayor of the municipal borough of Walthamstow in 1941. So young Keith is absorbing this heavy, heavy atmosphere of structure, public service, and working class discipline.
A mayor for a grandmother and a wounded soldier for a father. I mean, that is a heavy anchor of responsibility. But then you look at the other side of the family, he has this maternal grandfather, Augustus Theodore Dupree.
Gus.
Yeah, everyone called him Gus, and Gus is basically living in a totally different universe.
Entirely different. Gus was a touring jazz big band leader. He fronted a group called Gus Dupree and His Boys.
That is quite the contrast.
It really is. So while the paternal side is organizing political rallies and working in factories, the maternal side is roaming the country playing improvisational jazz. And it was Gus who ultimately tipped the scales. He is the one who put the very first guitar into his grandson's hands.
And it wasn't just the grandfather pulling him toward music, right? Like the school system got involved too.
Yeah, they did.
The choir master at Dartford Tech, this guy named R.W. Jake Clare, recruits him into this elite boy soprano trio, which is how we get to that surreal image of him singing classical arrangements for royalty at Westminster Abbey.
It's just wild to think about.
It really is. But this brings up a massive contradiction. I mean, how does a kid steeped in such strict, civic-minded discipline pivot so sharply into becoming the poster child for rock and roll rebellion? It just doesn't track for me.
Well, what's fascinating here is that we tend to view discipline and rebellion as opposites. But for him, they really weren't. The discipline is precisely what enabled the rebellion.
Wait, really? How does that work?
When he heard early rock and roll, specifically the guitar playing of Scotty Moore, he didn't just casually strum along to the radio. He attacked that guitar with the exact same relentless rigor that a choir master demands of a soprano, or that a mayor applies to running a city.
Wait, so the rebellion wasn't just aimless teenage flailing?
Not at all. It was a highly structured obsession. He took all of that inherited working-class discipline and pointed it like a laser at mastering the American blues.
Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that.
Yeah, he wasn't rejecting structure. He was just applying it to a domain his parents didn't understand.
That completely refounds everything. But eventually, the traditional structure around him did have to break, right? And the sources show that the specific moment he stepped out of line academically is what inadvertently set the stage for the rest of his life.
It did, yeah. By 1959, the traditional academic route completely collapsed. He was expelled from Dartford Tech for chronic truancy.
Just skipping class all the time.
Exactly. And that expulsion is the real pivot point here. Because of it, he gets transferred to Sidcup Art College.
And Sidcup seems less like a school and more like, I don't know, an incubator for the British invasion, because instead of going to class, he meets a guy named Dick Taylor.
Right.
And they spend their days holed up in the boys' bathroom playing guitar. And I just love the detail about the bathroom, because any musician will tell you that the acoustics in a tiled bathroom make a cheap guitar sound massive.
Oh, for sure. It's the perfect echo chamber.
But he wasn't just making random noise in there. He was obsessively decoding Chuck Berry guitar solos.
Which is an incredibly difficult thing to do by ear from a vinyl record. You have to listen, stop, rewind, figure out the exact fingering, and then repeat it hundreds of times.
So again, that intense rigor we were talking about.
Exactly. And that preparation in the bathroom is what makes the next event, the famous train ride, so significant.
Oh, man. The train ride. This is the moment that always gets painted as this magical, predestined event in rock history.
Yeah.
Set the scene for us.
So it's 1961. He is standing on a train platform and happens to run into Mick Jagger. Now, they weren't total strangers. The sources note they had actually gone to Wentworth Primary School together.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they lived in the same neighborhood until about 1954. But they hadn't seen each other in 7 years. Jagger is standing there on his way to classes at the London School of Economics.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Jagger is carrying a stack of mail-order rhythm and blues albums from Chess Records, specifically Chuck Berry and Muddy Waters. And I want you, the listener, to think about what it meant to hold imported American records in post-war England, before the internet, before streaming. These albums weren't just sitting in the local shop. You had to hunt them down. You had to send away for them.
It took real effort.
Exactly. So seeing someone holding those specific Chess records was like seeing someone flash a secret badge. It's like a contraband language. It immediately tells you, oh, you speak the same obscure dialect that I do.
It was an instant connection.
But I have to push back on the mythology here just a little bit. If Jagger isn't holding those exact Muddy Waters and Chuck Berry records on that specific day, does the biggest rock band in history even exist?
It's a great point. This raises an important question about how we view serendipity.
Yeah.
Yes, the chance encounter is incredibly lucky. If Jagger is carrying a newspaper instead of those records, maybe they just nod at each other and walk away.
Right, just a casual hello.
But the reason that moment ignited anything at all is because of the obsessive study that had already happened. If he hadn't spent those countless hours in the art school bathroom dissecting Chuck Berry solos, he wouldn't have recognized the immense value of what Jagger was holding.
So the magic wasn't the meaning itself. The magic was the synthesis of their shared obsession.
Precisely.
Mm.
It was two people recognizing a mutual, highly niche dedication. That shared code led to an immediate connection.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and Jagger was already singing in an amateur group with their mutual friend from art school, Dick Taylor. The band is called Little Boy Blue and the Blue Boys. And almost immediately, Keith joins them.
And once that connection is made, the dominoes just start falling, right?
They really do.
The Blue Boys eventually fold, but they take that shared love for the blues to the Bricklayers Arms Pub. And that's where they meet a guy named Brian Jones. Then they meet Ian Stewart. The momentum is just unstoppable at this point.
It really was.
By mid-1962, the notes say he actually drops out of Sidcup Art College altogether. He moves into a dingy London flat with Jagger and Jones. The foundation is officially poured.
It is a staggering sequence of events, all cascading from that shared dedication to deciphering the blues. And it moves incredibly fast.
Yeah, blink and you miss it.
Because by 1963, they are officially signed to Decca Records. And this is a really interesting moment, because this is where we see the machinery of the music industry step in to shape his identity.
Oh, this part's wild.
Their manager, a man named Andrew Log Oldham, makes a unilateral decision. He just drops the S from Richard's surname. He tells him he is now Keith Richard, simply because it supposedly looked more pop.
just casually rewriting the guy's family name to make him slightly more palatable for teenagers buying magazines.
Just like that.
Hold on to that thought, because we are definitely coming back to it at the end, but I want to move from their public image into how they actually made the music, because there is this massive, entrenched narrative about the Rolling Stones in the studio. You always hear people talk about the Weave, right?
Yes. The concept of the Weave is totally central to their mythology. For those who might not know, a traditional rock band usually has very defined roles. You have a rhythm guitarist playing the chords and a lead guitarist playing the solos.
Very structured.
Right. But the Stones became famous for blurring that line entirely. The interplay between him and bandmates like Brian Jones, Mick Taylor, and later Ronnie Wood was supposedly this magical, chaotic alchemy.
Like they were reading each other's minds.
Exactly. It sounded messy, organic,
yeah,
and unpredictable. You couldn't tell who was driving the song and who was decorating it.
It sounds like a beautifully chaotic democracy. But when you look at the source material we are diving into today, it completely destroys that myth. Wait, so you're telling me the band most famous for its telepathic dual guitar attack actually relied entirely on Keith playing all by himself for their most monumental anthems?
It's one of the most striking details in these documents.
Yeah.
The public narrative is the Weave. But the reality of the recording studio was often a completely solitary exercise.
That is just crazy to me.
The sources explicitly state that he plays the absolute only guitar tracks on some of their most iconic hits. We were talking about Paint It Black, Ruby Tuesday, Sympathy for the Devil, Gimme Shelter, and Angie.
That is mind-blowing. If he's playing all the guitar parts on Gimme Shelter, that means he's essentially faking that chaotic chemistry with himself.
He really is.
He's laying down the rhythm, and then he's going back into the booth alone to weave a lead line around his own playing, deliberately making it sound like two guys feeding off each other in the moment.
Exactly. It requires a staggering amount of premeditation and control to manufacture that kind of looseness.
Yeah.
It is not an accident.
So what does this all mean for how we view him? To me, it brings to mind a world-famous head chef. You know, the archetype, the chef who is famous for running this loud, aggressive kitchen. Pans are flying, cooks are shouting, there's fire everywhere.
Right, the whole spectacle.
Yeah, that's what the customers see, and they love the energy. But the reality is that at 5 in the morning, long before anyone else arrives, that chef is alone in a silent kitchen, meticulously prepping the ingredients and cooking the signature sauces all by himself. He does the heavy lifting in total isolation so that when the rest of the crew shows up, they can throw it in the pan and make a beautiful mess.
That is a brilliant analogy. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it reveals a profound duality that most people completely miss.
Right.
The public sees the messy, improvisational, bohemian aesthetic, which is an aesthetic that traces all the way back to his jazz musician grandfather, Gus. But the reality of creating those timeless records required a rigorous, highly structured mindset.
The discipline side.
Exactly. And that traces right back to the civic-minded grandparents and the exacting choir master. He wasn't merely a participant in the chaos of the Rolling Stones. He was the meticulous, solitary architect who engineered the foundation so the chaos could happen.
The solitary architect. That is the perfect way to phrase it. And that architecture didn't just stop at playing the instruments, did it? His role behind the mixing board as a producer was massive.
Oh, absolutely. The notes detail his heavy involvement in production starting in the 1960s. There is a bit of ambiguity early on, though.
How so?
Well, for example, he is credited as producer and musical director on a 1966 project called Today's Pop Symphony, which was really just the manager's side project. And then on their 1967 album, the production credit simply went to the entire band.
It's a blanket credit. But by the mid-70s, they stopped pretending it was a democracy in the control room, right? By 1974, he and Jagger officially formalized their partnership behind the board. They adopted the pseudonym the Glimmer Twins.
Yes, they did. And from that point on, even when they collaborated with other engineers or producers, the Glimmer Twins were calling the shots.
They were the bosses.
They maintained absolute creative control over how the band sounded. And his production skills were sought after outside the band as well. Moving into the 1980s and beyond, he wrapped up production credits with absolute legends. People like Aretha Franklin and Ronnie Spector trusted him behind the board.
Wow, Aretha Franklin, that really says something. And we can't ignore the music he made completely outside the Stones ecosystem either. It wasn't a huge volume of work, but it was highly intentional.
Very intentional.
His very first solo single came out in 1978, and what did he choose to play? A cover of Chuck Berry's Run, Rudolph Run. It's like he's constantly circling back to those chess records he studied in the art school bathroom.
It is a testament to how foundational that music was for him.
Yeah.
He never strayed far from the core mechanics of the blues. It was his anchor.
And later on, he puts together his own solo project, The Expensive Winos. And he doesn't just hire random session players. He builds a band of absolute heavyweights. You've got Waddy Wachtel on guitar, Bobby Keys on sax, Ivan Neville, Charlie Drayton. He even released an album as recently as 2015 called Cross-Eyed Heart.
Yeah, and what all of this points to, the solo work, the production, the secret solitary tracking in the studio, is a man who is fundamentally a craftsman.
A true professional.
The leather jacket and the cigarette are the performance. The underlying reality is a tireless worker who never, ever stops studying his craft.
It really is an incredible arc when you step back and look at the whole picture. We started with a young boy in post-war England, raised by a socialist mayor and an injured veteran, learning the absolute rigors of vocal performance in a church choir.
Right.
And then we watched him become a truant art student, using that exact same rigor to obsessively decipher imported blues records in a tiled bathroom. We saw how that specific prepared knowledge allowed a chance encounter on a train to ignite a musical revolution.
That's quite the journey.
And finally, we uncovered the solitary architect behind the mixing board, meticulously playing every guitar part himself to build rock's greatest anthems, all while letting the world believe in the magic of a chaotic weave.
I think the real takeaway for anyone listening to this deep dive is a very powerful lesson about the true nature of mastery.
Yeah.
We all love the idea of the rebel, you know,
the
person who effortlessly breaks all the rules of society. But true freedom, the ability to successfully break those rules and create something lasting, only comes after you have spent the quiet, solitary hours mastering the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
The riffs only work because the rigor came first.
That is perfectly said. The riffs only work because the rigor came first. Love that. But before we wrap up today, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. Something that builds on what we discussed, but looks at it from a slightly different angle.
Okay, let's hear it.
Remember when we talked about the year 1963? The band had just signed to Decca, and their manager, Andrew Lug Oldham, decided that the name Keith Richards wasn't catchy enough. He dropped the S. He packaged him as Keith Richard to look more pop. And Keith just went along with it.
It is a small detail, but an incredibly revealing one.
Right. According to the notes, he didn't formally reclaim his actual family name. He didn't put the S back until the late 1970s. Think about what that means. What does it say about the massive, unyielding machinery of fame when even the ultimate rock rebel, the guy who symbolized total anti-establishment freedom for an entire generation, allowed his very identity to be altered for mass consumption?
It really makes you pause and think.
Does true creative freedom, the simple ability to demand that the world call you by your own true name, only come after you've successfully played the industry's game and conquered the globe? It really makes you wonder how much of the rock star was always a calculated performance, and how much of that disciplined boy soprano was always quietly pulling the strings in the background. Think about that the next time you hear one of those legendary guitar intros kick in. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.